Before we get to today's show, a special request to any of you who are American expats living overseas. We want to hear from you about what it's like to vote by mail from abroad. As the primaries and November 3rd draw near, what questions or worries do you have about getting your vote in the mail and getting it counted back in your home state? Email a voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name, your location, and we might contact you for a story. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And thank you. Now here's today's show. Today on The World, an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin is in intensive care. One theory, Alexei Navalny drank a cup of hot tea that had been poisoned.
The idea here being that hot liquid was more likely to absorb quickly into his body.
Also today, the Trump White House is banning a Chinese messaging app. Many Chinese Americans can't imagine life without it.
WeChat is often the first thing I check in the morning when I wake up and the last thing I check before I go to bed.
And an Australian dating show hits the U.S., but does it exploit or does it normalize?
This series follows young adults on the autism spectrum.
An A-plus partner looks like me.
As they navigate the confusing world of relationships and dating.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for being with us today. We begin in Thailand. It is seeing its largest protest since the country's last military coup in 2014. The movement is driven by university students who say they're fed up with the military's heavy hand in politics and with laws limiting free speech. Get out, they're chanting, talking about the current government. That's from the largest protest, which brought out more than 10,000 people in Bangkok on Sunday. To explain what's happening in Thailand, the world's Patrick Nguyen joins us from Bangkok. What are these protests really about, Patrick?
You know, Marco, I would describe it broadly as an anti-establishment protest. You know, the most powerful political force in the country is the military, and so that's who these students are mostly angry at. Thailand's army has staged 13 coups in the past, and there was an election last year, but the army in many ways still has their hand on the steering wheel, and they have many ways to stop any up-and-coming political force from trying to pull their fingers off the steering wheel. And so what you're seeing from these students is a pushback to that, and it's kind of becoming this catch-all for all sorts of frustrations. So I've been to these protests, and I've heard people saying all sorts of things, from why is the army locking up critics, to why is abortion still illegal, to why are public school students forced to get short haircuts. So it's everything. Thai society in general is pretty conservative, and these students feel like it's stuck in the past. And I'll give you an example of that. Every morning, students have to stand before the flag, and they have to sing the national anthem, and it sounds like this. So in that clip, which went viral, you hear students singing the anthem, as they're forced to do, but all of them are holding up three fingers in the air. And they borrowed that from the movie Hunger Games, which is about, you know, rebel citizens resisting a tyrannical government. So it's very pop culture infused. They're just trying to find all of these ways to signal their frustration. And in this movement, you have some university students in their 20s who are going even farther and breaking even bigger taboos.
So, Patrick, given the unprecedented scale of these protests, what taboos, what no-go zones are these demonstrators breaking here? What are the risks of speaking out?
Yeah, and this gets really sensitive. Some of the more prominent voices from this movement have been talking about the monarchy, and the monarchy is very close to the military in Thailand. So students grow up in Thailand learning that the monarchy is just at the pinnacle of society, and the monarchy is protected by all these really strict laws in Thailand. It's considered legally sacrosanct and above criticism. So this faction in the movement has put out these 10 requests to reform the laws surrounding the monarchy. And that might not sound much, but to say that that's controversial is just a massive understatement. It's very risky. And I asked one of the protesters what he thinks about this.
ทุกคนที่กล่าวหาเด็กๆหรือประชาชนที่ออกมาประท้วงไม่สามารถพูดได้เลยว่าพวกเราหมิ่นอะไรท่านหรือว่าเราทำอะไรที่เป็นการหมิ่นท่าน
So he's saying, and I'm not going to give out his name. He's saying everybody who says we're insulting the palace is wrong. There's no proof. In their view, they say, well, we're talking about laws that surround the monarchy, that surround the palace, the laws that say you can't analyze or criticize its role in society. We're not trying to insult the royal family. So their vision is to have a legal system that would be something closer to the United Kingdom, you know, where people very openly talk about the Queen and gossip about Prince Harry and what he's wearing and all that. Again, that is just very hard to fathom in Thailand, and going anywhere near that red line is very risky.
So what's next for this movement and these protests?
Well, I think if these protesters stick to mostly challenging the military, Thailand has seen that before. For decades, there's been this cycle of pushback against military power. It seldom works out great for the protesters, but it's not unprecedented. Their primary goal is to have Parliament dissolve and the government redesigned so that the military isn't pulling so many strings. If this faction within the movement continues talking about the palace, they are very likely in trouble. In fact, they're already in trouble, Marco. Some of the young men and women who have gone that route have been charged with sedition. Some have been picked up. Some are out on bail. Some are in custody. And so this is what happens when you cross that line.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Protests now half a world away. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has ratcheted up efforts to reassert control and crush street protests in his country. Protesters say Lukashenko rigged the vote in an election there 10 days ago. Authorities have clamped down with rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Thousands of protesters have been detained, and what they describe is troubling. That's what we're going to hear now. And a quick warning, some of the details are violent and disturbing. Please take care while listening. Valentin Stefanovich is with Vesna, a Belarusian human rights organization in Minsk.
We have serious crisis with the human rights situation in our country. And before the protests, we have 26 political prisoners, including the husband of the candidate Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, Sergei Tsikhanouskaya, who's also still in prison. Mm. And on 9th of August, after the results of election, thousands of people in all the country came to the protests. And it was a peaceful protest, but they was attacked by the police who used the weapons, and a lot of people still in the hospital. Now, more than 6,000 people were detained. This is official information, but we think it will be more. Now we collect a lot of information about the torture that was massive and systematical.
So if those numbers of people detained are accurate, it's really stunning. How are those detainees treated in prison? Do you have any reports?
Yes, for now we collect this information and we will prepare the report. It's difficult to say now how many people was tortured. We have more than 500 stories of them from different parts of the countries. And it was really brutal when the people was beaten everywhere. They was beaten in polling stations, then after in the detention centers.
How have you been able to confirm those reports?
We asked people to come and say their stories, and we made videotapes of the people. And also, we had special forms, Google forms, when people can just send out information with a photo. Also, we met with people in the hospitals and talked with them.
How many cases are you processing, Valentin?
That's hundreds of them, I think. We have a lot of information, not direct information, because not all people are ready to talk about that. But we have at least one story when we can say that the man was raped. And also today, the investigation office said that they check information about the rapes of the woman who was in the detention center. And they said we haven't any appellations from them. But it's, of course, who can appeal to the police that the police raped them? So it's quite strange logic.
I asked you about treatment of detainees in prison, and you started talking immediately about torture. How widespread is it in Belarus?
I think it was a massive and it was a systematical. It was in all of the country. It was not only in Minsk. It was in other cities. And we have some witnesses from the police officers who just left the police after that. For example, in Lida, this is in Grodno region, the colonel of the police who left the police after that, he said openly about his witnesses, what he saw, how it was in this city. And when the police really brutally beaten people in polling stations, of course, not all policemen support that. For example, in this Lida city, 13 policemen just left from the police after that.
I was going to ask you, is the treatment you're describing, is it being ordered from on high by President Lukashenko's associates, or do you think these are individual police who are especially hard?
No, I think it was not some individual's decisions or some excess of some policemen. No, it looked like it was systematical. It was a lot of police special troops who did that. And I think it was like punishment of the people who participate in anti-government demonstrations, because when they beaten people, they said, you are not a patriot. Why are you against our state? You paid outside for our enemies. And they beaten them. It was a completely political motivated, and it was like a punishment.
I'm speaking with Valentin Stefanovich in Minsk, who represents the Belarusian human rights organization, Vesna. There are also reports that prisons in Belarus are at capacity and that makeshift camps are being used to detain people. What do you know about that?
Yes, it was not enough spaces to detain people. And for example, in one room in the isolator center in Minsk was like 40, 50 people, only for five, for example, of the prisoners. It's in that the people just slept on the floor or they can't sleep at all. And also police send the prisoners to other part of the country. For example, for the special camps, like it was in near with Slutsk and Minsk region, this is a medical working camps. This is a quite strange institutions that we still have since USSR collapsed for the isolation of antisocial elements, how the government called them, the people who are alcohol abused. And they send the prisoners to that camp and they spend a few days in this place. And after they was released.
So, Valentin, you've spoken about repression and abuse and torture. Have any activists died in this post-election moment in Belarus?
Yeah, we know about four cases, and this all cases recognized by the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Two men was shot by police during the demonstration. One case was in Minsk, and the second one was in Brest, and unfortunately this man died yesterday in a hospital because he was shot from the gun to the head by the police during the demonstration. And one more man, 25 years old, he died in Homel because he hadn't any help from the police when he was detained, and he had some problems with the heart. They not called to the doctors and he died. So it's four cases, but of course it's a lack of information because we had on the internet 2 or 3 days. I can say that I am not trust the official results. Maybe we will have more cases when people died in prison also because they was beaten and tortured.
Valentin Stefanovich is with the Belarusian human rights organization Vesna. He's been speaking with us from Minsk. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for your attention. And if Belarusians heard us on the radio, I just call them to support us.
Coming up, ideas of love are universal.
It would be like a fairy tale.
A natural high, I suppose.
You would just feel very warm inside yourself as a person.
But an Australian reality show is getting mixed reactions for how it shows people on the autism spectrum looking for love.
You know, it's a show made by neurotypical people for neurotypical people. I don't think this show is made for autistic people to watch. It's not for us.
That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Alexei Navalny, the face of Russia's opposition, a lawyer, a politician, and a harsh critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Today, Navalny is in an intensive care unit in Siberia, suspected of poisoning. Reporter Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. Charles, how did all this play out, and has it been established that someone did indeed try to poison Navalny?
Well, it's still a developing story, and as far as whether he indeed was poisoned or not is still an open theory, depending on who you talk to. We do know that he was flying home from Tomsk in Siberia back to Moscow. On the flight, he didn't feel well, which prompted an emergency landing in Omsk, not to be confused with Tomsk. Navalny now is actually in a medically induced coma on a respirator at the hospital there. Doctors say he's in serious but stable condition, although they're, quote, fighting for his life. Also, Alexei's wife, Yulia, and his personal doctor are now there as well, though there were reports of some delays in getting access to Navalny initially, with lots of police on the scene.
So how did this happen? Have you heard any theories?
Well, his spokesperson, Kira Yarmush, made comments to media here. And so she says he just drank some black tea at the airport before the flight, and it's obvious that he was poisoned at that moment. The idea here being that hot liquid was more likely to absorb quickly into his body. You know, in fact, a passenger named Pavel Lebedev took a photo of Navalny sitting at the cafe in the airport before he got on the flight. He appeared to be drinking tea, and later the two of them ended up on that same flight. And it's interesting that at some point this Lebedev noticed howls coming from the laboratory. He realized then that the cries were coming from Navalny, and he ended up detailing all this in a post to social media once he touched down in Omsk.
So that was at the airport. What else can you tell us about this suspected poisoning? Is there any talk yet of a possible suspect or suspects or a motive?
No suspects yet. Certainly we know among Navalny's supporters, they find this to be no accident. Not surprising. They think it's politically motivated. Navalny has made his fair share of enemies with a series of reports on corruption in the highest rungs of the Russian government and of Russian business. He's certainly been attacked numerous times before, including in 2017 when provocateurs doused him with a green dye that partially blinded him for a period. Then again in 2019 when he was exposed to some toxic substance while serving a month prison term, which caused some skin lesions, but he made it okay. And of course, there's this troubling pattern of enemies or perceived enemies of the Russian state being poisoned, attacked, sometimes killed. You know, and this prompts this constant debate here over who's really behind them, and specifically whether Vladimir Putin really gains from these brazen attacks on his opponents, and that the Kremlin says are designed to make Putin look bad. And I want to bring in another voice here. This is Andrei Kolesnikov, an analyst with the Moscow Carnegie Center here.
Even if Kremlin doesn't know anything about it, it's quite strange because it means that this kind of events are uncontrollable. The FSB, local FSB, some enemies of Navalny could do it without sanction from Kremlin.
Now, the other option, says Kolesnikov, is that these orders are indeed coming from the top, from Putin. The point is we can suspect but never seem to really know. And interesting enough, the reaction to today's news from the Kremlin spokesman was to wish Navalny a speedy recovery.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you very much for this.
Thanks, Margot.
Dating shows are not exactly hard to find when you're scrolling through Netflix these days. But a new series out of Australia is making many people take a closer look at the genre. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
Watching single people date each other on TV has become a fixed part of the world's entertainment landscape. But what sets this show apart?
Beep, beep, beep.
This series follows young adults on the autism spectrum.
An A-plus partner looks like me.
Australian audiences watched Love on the Spectrum as the show's 11 autistic participants went on dates.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Chloe.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Got advice from family.
Hello.
Hi, miss.
Yeah.
If you need to, just twiddle your fingers or something if you're getting a little bit nervy.
And pondered about what love might feel like when they do find it.
It'll be like a fairy tale.
A natural high, I suppose.
You just feel very warm inside yourself as a person.
Love on the Spectrum recently dropped on Netflix in the US and the UK, and with a more global audience has come more discussion about the show's promises and pitfalls. It immediately grabbed the attention of Charlie Clement, an autistic activist in England.
As soon as I saw it, I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to watch that. And I ended up watching it all pretty much in one evening.
As Charlie wrote in a review for the British site Metro UK, she did find it, quote, liberating to see a group of young people so openly autistic on mainstream television. But
I was pretty quickly not very happy with it.
Charlie said one of the first things she noticed was there were no non-disabled people on the show.
And for me, that just purely said that we shouldn't be dating non-disabled people.
That's a view shared by Australian YouTuber Chloe Hayden, who is also autistic.
I know many, many, many autistic people that are dating or married to neurotypical people. The same way that you wouldn't pair someone that was blind with someone else that was blind just because they're both blind.
But other autistic viewers say they do see themselves accurately represented in the show. Carrie Magro, an autistic person and author of Autism and Falling in Love, says he resonated with one of the show's participants in particular.
Hello. My name is Michael.
Michael, a 25-year-old autistic man who says his greatest dream in life is
to become a husband.
Carrie said when he was 25, he was exactly like Michael.
There was a moment in the show when he's like,
a lot of girls, when they're still in high school, they only want a boyfriend, not just friend, of course, but also as a bodyguard and as a sugar daddy.
I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I would have said it exactly like that.
But Carrie continued, he relates to Michael's candor. Referring to scenes like that one, people praising the show online say it's funny, wholesome, and sweet. Critics say that very language is infantilizing, along with the part of the show when the narrator introduces someone new.
He likes playing drums and watching sunsets. He hates thunderstorms and the feeling of thongs between his toes.
Thongs there are what people down under call flip-flops. Netflix declined my interview request for this story. But in an interview on the Gist podcast, director Kian O'Cleary said he considers Love on the Spectrum to be more of a documentary than a reality series. And he spoke about the line between having fun and making fun of the show's subjects.
To me, it is a line that you feel and that is in your gut. And just knowing that you are wanting to make something that is completely respectful to all the people who participated in it.
The end product does feature a psychologist and relationship coach, which was refreshing to see for author Carrie Magro, who himself has been an autism consultant on TV shows and movies. He says Love on the Spectrum makes him hopeful that he, now 32, will find love one day. But British reviewer Charlie Clement has a different takeaway.
You know, it's a show made by neurotypical people for neurotypical people. I don't think this show is made for autistic people to watch. It's not for us.
Still, the show has been a commercial success. According to the production company's website, season 2 is currently underway for an Australian network. It's unclear if Netflix will also pick up the second season for viewers across the globe. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. As climate change intensifies, tens of millions of people will be forced to migrate. But tough border restrictions prevent that.
The tragedy of these people who are displaced by climate change is not that they're going to move somewhere. It's that they're trapped and they can't move anywhere.
Finding legal migration solutions. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Exactly 1 month from today, that's when many people in this country, Chinese Americans especially, may have to stop using WeChat, an app that keeps them connected to China. President Trump's executive order targeting the Chinese messaging app WeChat goes into effect on the 20th of September. The Trump administration says the app poses a national security risk and a privacy risk to anyone who uses it. The prospect of losing WeChat has put people in the U.S. with connections to China on edge. But as The World's Lydia Emanuelito reports, they're also conflicted.
Frankie Huang, a writer and illustrator based in the Boston area, first heard about WeChat years ago. She was living in China at the time.
I was taking a hip-hop dance class in Beijing, and my teacher
said, I should add you on WeChat and Weixin in China. And I was like, I don't know what this is.
Today, WeChat is just too big to miss. It's a social media app, an e-commerce platform, a blogging site, banking tool, ride-hailing service, and so many other things, all rolled into this one super app. It's extremely popular in China and beyond.
I feel like every Chinese-speaking person and people with connections to China are on WeChat, and it's just this really powerful network.
A network of more than 1 billion users worldwide. 19 million of them, like Huang, are in the U.S. Huang uses WeChat to stay in touch with family and friends and to follow in-app blogs and other posts, which she relies on for her research and writing.
It's become something really indispensable in my life.
It's hard to overstate just how important this one app is for so many Chinese Americans and for people with personal and business connections to China.
WeChat is often the first thing I check in the morning when I wake up and the last thing I check before I go to bed.
Charlie Gu runs a marketing agency in San Francisco. He uses the app to talk and text with his family back in China, where he was born and grew up.
We have a WeChat group, all the family members, including, you know, extended family members like cousins.
WeChat is one of the few options they have since so many other messaging and social media platforms are banned in China. And Gu says WeChat is useful in lots of other ways. For example, he says, local governments in U.S. cities with big Chinese immigrant populations rely on it to put out crucial public service announcements. So when he heard the Trump administration was targeting WeChat through an executive order, Gu says he was rattled.
I thought a ban on WeChat was impossible because WeChat is simply too big to be banned.
To be clear, WeChat hasn't been banned in the U.S., and it's not a sure thing that it will be. The executive order President Trump signed earlier this month is vague and unclear. It prohibits people in the U.S. from carrying out transactions on WeChat starting in late September. Gu is scared about how any restrictions will affect him, not just personally, but also professionally. His marketing agency, Collective Influence, with a K, relies on WeChat to introduce and promote American brands to the Chinese market.
I've heard from clients and business partners about the confusion of what this means. They're just waiting to see what exactly the executive order will cover.
Ray Zong is also waiting to see how this executive order plays out. She's with the Wilson Center, a think tank in Washington, D.C. She uses WeChat for her research on U.S.-China relations and to communicate with her family back in China.
My family's from Wuhan, so we've really had a roller coaster of a year.
During the height of the outbreak in Wuhan earlier this year, Zong was using WeChat to make sure her grandparents, who are in their 70s and 80s, were staying safe, getting their groceries, their prescriptions. She doesn't know if and how this order will impact her ability to text her grandparents. But one thing that is clear, she said, is that the Trump administration's targeting of WeChat is part of a pattern. It's been cracking down on several Chinese apps and tech giants like TikTok and Huawei.
For a long time, we've seen these companies conduct business in ways that U.S. policy regulators haven't really found an issue with. But as diplomatic relations between China and the U.S. unraveled throughout 2020, I think that's definitely an environment that we're going to see change.
When it comes to WeChat specifically, even those who rely heavily on the app say there's good reason to take action against it. Researchers and human rights activists have tracked how the Chinese government uses WeChat to surveil its citizens, to spread propaganda, and to censor those who speak out against it. But even WeChat's fiercest critics say a ban here in the U.S. is not the way to go.
We don't believe this country should do that. It is not in line with a democratic value.
Jen Li Young is a former political prisoner of China and a longtime human rights activist based here in the U.S. Young, along with D.C.-based lawyer Times Wong, have been working on a series of lawsuits against WeChat on behalf of U.S. users who say they were censored or surveilled through the app. Wong, the lawyer, says any U.S. action on WeChat needs to be calculated.
If you look at this from the Chinese Communist Party's perspective, nothing would make them happier than a ban because it legitimizes their way of governing.
Instead, Wong and Young say, the U.S. should take action that specifically targets the censorship, surveillance, and other abuses they say the Chinese government is doing through the app. That would be more in line with U.S. values and wouldn't necessarily cut off what many in the Chinese diaspora see as a lifeline to China. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
The line that candidate Trump wheeled out in 2016 that really seemed to catch on with his voters was build that wall. The wall between the U.S. and Mexico didn't go up fast enough for some supporters, so they wrote checks to the group We Build the Wall.
To help us get to our goal. With a slightly higher donation, we'll put your name or a patriotic message on a brick.
Now, Steve Bannon, President Trump's former advisor, has been arrested and charged with defrauding donors to that fundraising drive. Bannon and three other defendants allegedly used more than $1 million from donations for personal expenses, everything from a luxury SUV to plastic surgery, according to the indictment. The southern border wall is the symbol of Trump's immigration policy. In her new book, Hate Monger, investigative reporter Jean Guerrero focuses on White House advisor Stephen Miller for pushing Trump to implement policies that have impacted people's lives in ways that are far less visible than the wall.
Before Stephen Miller joined Trump's campaign in 2016, Trump's only real immigration proposal was the border wall. And immigration restrictionists who had been following this issue for a very long time and wanted to see lower levels of immigration, they kind of just rolled their eyes at that. I mean, they knew that the United States had had hundreds of border barriers since the 90s and that it hadn't done very much to decrease overall flows of immigration. And it wasn't until Stephen Miller came onto his campaign and started pulling policy ideas directly from think tanks funded by eugenicists and white supremacists who believe in population control for non-white people that he started to bring to the table ways to decrease overall immigration.
And few inside the Trump administration seem to question, at least publicly, Miller's role as this architect of the president's restrictive immigration policies. Miller's clearly powerful. So how do you see Stephen Miller shaping the president's current reelection strategy?
Right now, he's responsible for the reelection strategy revolving around the demonization of the entire Democratic Party as an existential threat to civilization. You know, this is something that comes from Stephen Miller's white supremacist readings, this idea that liberals and people who partner with immigrants and with people of color pose some kind of threat to the nature of Western civilization as we know it. And you see the language that Trump is using right now, you know, talking about anarchists and agitators who want to destroy America, talking about an unhinged left-wing mob, talking about far-left fascism. This is all language that Stephen Miller is inserting into Trump's speeches, which he is pulling from his white supremacist readings, like this book called The Camp of the Saints, which is a neo-Nazi read that talks about the destruction of the white world by agitators and anarchists and mobs, anti-racists who partner up with people of color.
So, Jean, I want to ask you this. We see lots of images and references to kids in cages. I mean, some of the most upsetting things to come out of White House policy. But how do you view those images, like the roots and origins of those images? Do you lay it all at Stephen Miller's doorstep?
The crackdown on immigrants that we see today is largely the logical outcome of a bipartisan assault on immigration that we've been seeing in the United States for decades. Under the Obama administration, we saw record deportations. You saw family separations in that way, with fathers getting separated from their families. The thing about Stephen Miller and what makes him so extreme and so different from everything that we've seen before is that he is fundamentally motivated by this desire to maintain a white majority in the United States. He would deny that, but when you look at everything that he is pulling his policy ideas from and his affinity for white supremacist and white nationalist literature, you recognize that ultimately this is his goal. And this is why, with Stephen Miller at the helm of immigration policy under the Trump administration, we have seen a disproportionate impact on families who have broken no laws.
I'm speaking with Jean Guerrero, the author of Hate Monger, which tells the story of White House advisor Stephen Miller. Jean, what has Miller not checked off his to-do list that you would expect will materialize if Trump wins a second term?
There is a blueprint for immigration policy that was issued by the Federation for American Immigration Reform in November of 2016. This is a think tank that was funded by John Tanton, a eugenicist who believes in population control for non-white people. And Stephen Miller has checked off nearly everything on that list, except for one thing, and that is eliminating birthright citizenship. if we see a second term, this is absolutely going to be a focus of the Trump administration.
If there is a new administration come January next year, how much of what Miller's pushed through so far is reversible?
Many of the executive orders that were issued in January of 2017, which expand Border Patrol and ICE's ability to keep people detained regardless of whether they've committed any crimes and expanded their ability to deport people, you know, even if they're children, these are all things that can be revoked. And you can start to change the way that Border Patrol and ICE treat people who have broken no laws pretty quickly. The thing that is going to be a lot more difficult is rebuilding the refugee admission system, not only in infrastructure, but also in reputation. I mean, for decades, the United States was seen as a beacon of hope and refuge across the world. And Stephen Miller has deliberately destroyed that reputation and also attacked the infrastructure that's in place that was easy to destroy, but is not going to be easy to rebuild. You know, entire offices that were closed across the world, you know, employees that need to be rehired, that is going to take a very long time to restart.
Jean Guerrero's latest book is called Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. Great to have you with us, Jean. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Here's what we've been hearing about the coronavirus in Turkey. The country's done a pretty good job handling the outbreak. Turkey never had to go into a full lockdown, and its per capita death rate is lower than most of Western Europe. But many Turkish doctors are concerned that the outbreak is much worse than the government is letting on. Duru Buscarin has more from Istanbul.
As long as you're wearing a mask, Istanbul is largely open for business again. People ride the bus to work. They gather at crowded outdoor cafes. On weekends, they take their kids to the city beaches. Even the tourists are starting to trickle back. Plenty of people still work from home. You might get your temperature checked entering a mall or a restaurant. But for a lot of Turkish society, life feels almost normal. Until you pass through the walls of a hospital. Doctors who work for public hospitals in Turkey face retaliation from the government if they speak publicly without permission. So we spoke to this ICU doctor anonymously over the phone on his lunch break.
Actually, right now, the danger we are facing is very big.
Every day, he takes care of patients with the worst of coronavirus infections, intubating patients so they can keep breathing while their body fights the infection. Only half will make it out of this unit alive, a statistic that tracks with a lot of hospitals around the world.
Most of our patients are elderly, and they have other illnesses too. But we also have young patients, like 17 years old in the ICU, or patients in their 20s and 30s who died without chronic conditions.
And this number appears to be climbing. After the Muslim holiday of Bayram, he says, his hospital went from one ICU unit full of coronavirus patients to four. But Turkey's Ministry of Health has only registered a slight increase in case numbers. This doctor is one of several who say the numbers are deliberately underreported.
We have started to self-censor.
He explains it this way. While most countries follow World Health Organization guidelines to count coronavirus cases, Turkey only counts cases that have been confirmed with a test. This doctor says that even if a patient is being treated for coronavirus, they might not be added to the official tally.
If a patient dies of COVID, but their last result is negative, we don't write it in the report because we know it's not going to be approved by the public health officials.
Turkey's largest doctors association has released public statements warning of undercounted case numbers since the beginning of the pandemic. Dr. Halis Yerlikaya is a member of the association's governing council. He says that in Turkey's largely Kurdish southeast, where he's based, intensive care units are full. Patients with minor symptoms are being turned away from hospitals to make room for more serious cases.
At the beginning of the pandemic, we were able to do the necessary treatment. But right now, we can't hospitalize people. We can't accept patients because we have no capacity. The same is true for the whole region.
Meanwhile, most healthy people live their lives as if everything is normal. Government officials, including President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, have acknowledged that case numbers are going up, but deny that any hospitals are full. At an opening ceremony for a new research center, he pointed to Turkey's success in the pandemic compared to other countries.
Salgın döneminde pek çok gelişmiş ülkenin
We witnessed the collapse of healthcare systems of many developed countries during the epidemic period. We have seen states that cannot maintain their supply chain despite their economic strength and cannot maintain public order.
State and pro-government media don't question Turkey's official statistics. They favor stories about spiking case rates in other parts of the world and miraculous recoveries of strong elderly Turks. For doctors on the front lines who aren't permitted to speak publicly, this is infuriating.
Yani alınan normalleşme kararı insan sağlığından daha ziyade ekonomik.
The decision to reopen was based on economic reasons, not actually human health. What we are saying is that the health of a human is more precious than the economy.
For that reason, he says, he hopes people continue to self-isolate as much as possible. The worst, he fears, is yet to come. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Here's how I start my day, in case you were wondering. Crank up the coffee, take my dog Frankie around the block, and read as much as I can about the news and stories that happened overnight while I was sleeping. If you're like me and want to start the day informed, then start it with the World's Morning Newsletter. We'll send it right to your email, so you've got it first thing when you wake up. Sign up for Top of the World on our website. That's theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. As climate change reshapes our planet, it's also going to change where we live. Up to 1 billion people are expected to move for environmental reasons by 2050, including to escape the worst impacts of drought, rising sea levels, and natural disasters. Today, we look at migration as a solution to climate change on this installment of The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
In a moment, we'll speak with a writer who has some thoughts about how migration can be a solution to climate change. But let's start with the world's Anna Kussmer to help us out at the baseline of this discussion. Anna, what makes someone a climate migrant? Define that.
A climate migrant is somebody who moves because of the impacts of climate change. That can be people who live in low-lying coastal areas or on island nations that are expected to be inundated by sea level rise. It can also be people who have, say, lost crops because of extended droughts or expanding deserts. It's very hard to tease out exactly who is a climate migrant because people move for very complex reasons. But climate change is a huge part of the picture of why people are on the move now and why people will be moving in the next decades.
So up to 1 billion people on the move by mid-century, is that right? Because that is huge.
It really depends on how bad climate change actually is. And it also depends on how much countries are able to adapt to the impacts of climate change. Right now, the UN says that 20 million people move a year for environmental reasons. Most affected are the people from poorer countries, and that dynamic will likely continue.
Are there legal migration pathways for climate migrants like there are for people who are fleeing war or persecution?
Most climate migration is actually domestic within countries, and there's no international protection for climate migrants. The UN and other international agencies are actually working to try to create legal protections. Climate migration is often framed as a crisis. Another way to think about it is that it's an adaptation. Yes, it's a result of climate change, but it's also in some ways a solution to climate change. And that is what we wanted to spend some time thinking about today on the show.
The World's Anna Kussmer, thank you very much for getting us started on this.
Thank you, Marco.
I spoke earlier this week with someone who spent a lot of time thinking about this. Sonia Shah, In her book, The Next Great Migration, Shaw argues that migration should be seen not as a crisis itself, but as a reaction or adaptation. She saw that firsthand while reporting in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian killed an estimated 2,000 people there last year. In her reporting, Sonia Shaw asked how many of those lives could have been saved if people had safe and legal pathways to move.
We think of these climate disasters as being catastrophic because people will have to move. But it's really just the opposite. When I went there, the tragedy was that people weren't allowed to move, that they had been trapped there, in particular, you know, marginalized communities in the Caribbean, like Haitian people in the Bahamas. They don't have a lot of pathways to move, even outside of a climate disaster of any kind. Even though we know that if you live on an island and you're vulnerable to catastrophic climate disasters, you will have to move across international borders. We don't have any legal pathways for people to do that anywhere in the world.
So recently you wrote about this and you underlined the well-worn narrative of people coming from the global south, how they're often seen as invaders after these catastrophes. How do you think historic colonialism and racism frame how climate migration is widely seen in our society?
I think this idea of migration as catastrophic goes right back to, you know, in the Western tradition anyway, our original ideas about what nature is and where people come from and where they belong. We're facing a lot of migration in our future, and some of it's already happening. And we don't really have a good way of thinking about that. We think about it as, well, let's try to turn the faucet off. Let's close the borders. And what we have today is more borders that are fortified with walls and fences than ever before in our history. We're also on the cusp of this great need for adaptive migration because of the climate crisis.
Yeah. So how do you reframe that point of view?
I think part of the roots of our idea of migration as a problem is because we think things are supposed to be still. It's a very deep habit of mind, I think. We do it for animals and people. Think of the animal maps that people put up in their nurseries for their kids to look at, where the camel stands in for the Middle East and the kangaroo stands in for Australia and the bear stands in for North America, as if those species are so stationary that they are kind of one and the same with that place. All of those things are just a snapshot in time. All of these species have been moving around a lot, and so have people. We really need to, I think, incorporate that migratory past into our ideas about who we are and where we belong.
Given how contentious immigration policy can be and how some politicians weaponize it, how realistically do you think climate migration could be made easier?
The sad fact is it's going to be made easier because it's going to start affecting a lot more people. This is not something that we are going to be able to sort of ghettoize as someone else's problem. You know, people in this country are having to move because of climate change. People in low-lying coastal areas in Louisiana, in around the Chesapeake Bay. People are having to move out of parts of California because of the fires. The complexities of those moves are going to force us to really confront, how are we going to manage this?
So redefining migration away from this sense of catastrophe, you also nod to some of the positive aspects of migration. For example, the fusion of cultures and art. You point to the music of the great Ethiopian jazz artist Mulatu Astatke and a song of his like Yeker Moso. Make the connection for us between migration and Mulatu Astatke's music.
His combination of traditional Ethiopian music and reggae and Latin rhythms and jazz, it just sort of travels along these deeply carved migratory routes from East Africa to South America to the Caribbean to Eurasia and North America, that our bodies have been traveling from the very beginning, you know, and continuing today, although with so much more difficulty. The sound is so familiar on one hand, but it's also kind of strangely different. It's that tension in his music, I think, which makes it so soulful and beautiful.
Yeker Moso, another product of migration, and Sonia Shaw, author of The Next Great Migration. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mulatu Astatke playing us out of today's show with Yeker Moso. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
from PRX.